Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
It's a real privilege to be here as part of FANDA. I got to know Jay and the FANDA group really because one of my activities has been, as you'll see, we're going to look at it in a bit. For 8 years now, I've been opposing a very large mosque. It was known generally as the Olympic Mega Mosque, which was planned to put up a mosque of capacity of 45 to 70,000. Wrap your head, 45 to 70,000, about half a mile from the Olympic Stadium. And the original plan was that it would be up in time for the 2012 London Olympics. As it happens, it's about a mile from where I lived then and about a mile from where I live now. I've moved, but not very far. It was right on my doorstep, and we'll be talking more about that itself. But also in terms of Islam, I'm quite involved with a member of the House of Lords, called, which is our second chamber, our senior chamber in our parliament, called Baroness Caroline Cox. And together with her, we and a group of others, lawyers and so on, we are trying to tackle Sharia courts, Sharia councils, and specifically the whole area of gender discrimination. If you know anything about Sharia, you'll know it very much discriminates against women for all sorts of reasons. I won't go into that, it's another whole debate. But she now currently has a bill, a private member's bill, going through the House of Lords, and we've been working on this for about 4 years now. It's been really interesting, really exciting. And I, with her, have spent hours talking to Muslim women, and Caroline Cox would say, she sat and cried with them. And actually, it had been really upsetting to hear what's happened to these Muslim women when they go before Sharia councils and Sharia courts, maybe asking for a divorce or whatever, and they really have the rough end of the stick. And I've had a fascinating time listening to their stories and trying to work this through in terms of legislation to go through the House of Lords and then into the House of Commons and so on. We've had a tremendous debate in the House of Lords with peers from all sides in favour. Our only problem, really, is the government is not, up until now, has not been in favour, and unless we get the fair wind from the government behind this bill, it will stay as a private member's bill and is highly unlikely to get through Parliament. However, the very fact we're having the debate is a good thing, because we are engaging with Muslim women up and down the country. They come down to the House of Lords. In fact, I'll just tell you a quick story. It's got nothing whatever to do with this, but I'll tell you a story, because it's one of my favourite stories. The House of Lords is very posh, very old, very traditional, okay, and they have a House of Lords tea room, and all these House of Lords. I have to say, they aren't all the way that Jay described them the other day. I think he described they're all very old and doddery, and they're all in wheelchairs. I'm really going to look forward to telling the members of the House of Lords that he knows quite well that that's how he describes them. Many of them are most of them, extremely intelligent people, at the top of their game, at the top of their profession. And they've been appointed to the House of Lords because they're extremely good surgeons or doctors or lawyers or whatever. I'm really quite amazed at this. But we sat there and we were consulting a lot of young Muslim women. And in the middle of the tea room, there's this large round table that can take about 10 people around there. So we sit there with Baroness Cox, who's in her 70s. She acts as if she's in her 40s, but she's actually in her 70s. We sit there. These young Muslim women who've come down to tell her their stories about how they've been oppressed and so on in Sharia courts up and down the country and what Sharia law had done for them. So I sit there. Some of them are in hijabs and so on. And myself, as a sole bloke, sitting at this table, and it's all right in the middle of the tea room like this, and you can see these apparently old gentlemen in wheelchairs doddering past. They're looking at this extraordinary sight of young Muslim women, an elderly member of the House of Lords, and one solitary male sitting in the middle of this tea room. It was a quite remarkable experience. That's not actually, it's a bit of a detour, and I haven't got a lot of time. That's not actually what I want to talk to you about. What I want to talk to you about, and the reason why I'm here, the other thing I need to say is, as you heard in previous sessions, is I live in a Muslim majority area. As it happens, the statistics at the 2011 census, national census, the neighbourhood where I am, the particular neighbourhood in East London where I am, has the highest proportion of Muslims of anywhere in London, not in England, but anywhere in London. So it's 51-52% of our population around me are Muslims. And I like living there. I like Muslim people. I want you to hear that. I do like Muslim people. I like living there. We live there by choice. And as another interesting statistic, the white Brits like me are now down to 5% of the population. The white flight has been massive from our area, and so on. So I live amongst Muslims, I work on Muslim issues, and so on, and then we're going to be talking a bit about the mosque. My purpose today now is to talk to you about how to discuss with you about how to encourage Christians, how to encourage people to engage with Muslims and to engage with Islam. At some level, the very fact that our numbers here are not large will tell you something about the issue itself. We have 700 people, all keen, committed leaders here, and yet you can see our numbers at large. That tells you something about it, about the problem that we have. And what I've done is I've set up a roadshow. The initiative for this actually came from, interestingly enough, it's the roadshow is called Can We Talk About Islam? It's a question mark. Can we talk about Islam? And the purpose of the roadshow is to go around churches encouraging Christians, particularly, to engage with Islam. And the initiative of this came from a man from abroad, quite a wealthy man from abroad, who loves Britain and is really quite concerned at the rising tide of Islam. Not all of it's bad, let's be absolutely clear about that, not all of it's bad, but much of it is at least hostile to our values in Britain. And he, although he's not a Christian particularly, he said what we need to do to challenge those aspects of Islam that are really not acceptable is we need to mobilise the churches. Now that's quite remarkable, isn't it? As a non-Christian who loves Britain, he's not a Briton, not a Brit himself. He has a property, he lives in Britain sometimes, but he decided that actually, if he's going to do anything, it must be to mobilise the churches, not the people outside. Mobilise the churches. So he has funded a something called the Roadshow, which we now have, which offers to go around churches and to encourage people to get involved with Islam. And that is what I do. I've set it up. I work with another guy called Peter who works on this full-time, and we now go around. We've been to one church, and I've got a whole programme starting in June going through other churches as well. So that is what we do. Why is it people in general, and why is it Christians don't want to engage, generally, with honourable exception, don't want to engage with Muslims, don't want to engage with Islam? Just throw out some reason. I'm not saying you. Why is it that people don't want to? Yeah, Peter.
Yeah, intimidation.
Sorry?
Intimidation.
Intimidation.
Yeah.
They feel intimidated by?
I think it's several things, but among other things, they are afraid they will offend and be called racist and be called
Islamophobic.
And at the same time, there is also an underlying fear maybe of violence sometimes.
They might find themselves attacked, like Theo Van Gogh or something like that. Okay, yeah.
Just in terms of some of the churches that we know, Christianity is quite a white middle class thing that happens in quite middle class areas. So just a lot of folk not really ever brushing shoulders with a Muslim, unless they're in a university context, perhaps, and might know some Muslim scholars that they're working alongside, who aren't really wearing their Islam very loudly. And so I just know lots of churches, so I'd love to see them supporting things, but their congregations just don't brush shoulders, because they all seem to be in the... I think it was your point, Bethy, yesterday or the other day, that Christians tend to go and move out of cities into suburbs, and Muslims tend to move into cities. So sometimes just geographical and lifestyle.
I think it's also true, at least in the States, it's been a problem somewhere else. I think it's changing now, and I think the Christians are a little bit afraid of, well, they don't really have a lot of depth and apologetics in their own faith, so how am I going to go and engage with other people? But I think you're going to see that changing, at least where I'm from, over the years.
Okay, yeah. I think in Europe as well, maybe some people feel it's not the main issue. And I think with ISIS, that's beginning to change, but still not the main issue that they have to deal with. Mm-hmm. We're glad someone is dealing with it now, because it is an issue now. It's not the main issue. So I think in some ways, until it becomes the main issue, which unfortunately will be too late at that point, then they'll start engaging. And the church tends to wait till a big problem comes and then they engage. And I think we've got to be a bit preemptive.
Any other reason?
Lack of good understanding of how to defend your faith in the first place.
Yes.
Not necessarily against Islam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, sure. And Muslims tend...
I could talk about that and
sure.
have my mouth shut, but it's... We may have homework to do at a basic level.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And quite often Muslims have some basics themselves. They say Allah is one, and Christians believe in three gods. They sort of say that, the average Christian doesn't know how to defend that.
But that gets answered if the average Christian actually does know how to defend their faith, if they feel it's important to be able to do it.
Sure. Okay.
I think Christians fare badly in the interfaith arena anyway. Unless you're a professional interfaith person, but generally they fare badly, and they fare exceptionally badly with Islam because it's quite a muscular and bitey religion. That there are aspects of that religion, in other words, people don't like offence, and the English Christians don't like to offend, and you've got a community who certainly don't like to be offended. So you've got there something very, very potent that disables the dialogue.
The English Christianity likes to be nice, doesn't it? So it likes to be nice to people and the rest of it. I think maybe I will show this first part. What I'm just going to show is when we do our roadshow, we go around and we persuade people that actually, as Beth is saying, Islam is the rising issue. Okay, it's a rising issue globally, it's a rising issue in the UK. So I'm very rapidly going to go through some PowerPoints that we've shown when we go to your average church, just to encourage them to realise just how significant this is. Now I'm going to show you parts of the impact of Islam. Of course, not all Islam is bad. We need to say that, and we were going to be looking later at separating Islam, as we have done a number of times already, separating Islam from Muslims, okay? But we would, I think I pressed the B, is that right?
B, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so Islam in Britain today, some of this is about Britain, but you can see that the Office of National Statistics, ONS, forecasts that the Islam will be the dominant religion in Britain in 10 years' time. That's what they're forecasting. At the moment in Britain, one in 10of the population under 25 are Muslim. Okay, that's where we are at the moment. We have, these are some random statistics, just to get you going. There are at least 85 Sharia courts in the United Kingdom. I have to say, it's a very difficult statistic. I think there are actually many more. We haven't got time to talk about Sharia courts, but actually anybody, if you are an imam, you can set yourself up as a Sharia court in your mosque anytime you want to. You quite simply say, I am a Sharia judge. And if people accept you, if your local community around you accept you as a Sharia judge, at least to give advice or to give rulings on family matters and family difficulties and so on, that is a Sharia court. So quite how we can say there are 85 Sharia courts. There are some that are much more official. They have websites and promote themselves as a court. There are others that are just the imam round the corner who's doing it. But there we go, at least 85 Sharia courts, maybe a lot more, actually. This issue of police turning blind eye to Muslim grooming gangs, this has been a huge issue recently in the United Kingdom. Perhaps you're all aware of that. But for a long, long time, primarily Pakistani men have been grooming young women across the north of England, and there's been huge cases, and not just in one or two. There've been from Oxford up to all over the country. There've been these grooming gangs, and it's been going on for years, known to the authorities, but actually they do nothing about it, and they freely admit now it's because what we would now call political correctness, and they're really quite concerned. They were really quite concerned about tackling an Islamic Muslim issue or an ethnic minority issue. So this has been going on for years, and it's completely shocked the country. Britain is now a world leader in Islamic finance. We'll come back to that in a moment. Muslim women have few rights. I could talk for hours about that with an experience, but I'll leave that. Britain has the highest FGM, female genital mutilation levels in Europe, from forward statistics. And prisons and universities are recognised now to becoming hotbeds for Islamic extremism. Globally, with the long-term projections for Christian and Muslim shares the world population, Islam is forecasted by some people. I've seen other statistics, I have to say, which say that Islam is never going to catch Christianity. But anyway, I put this out. This is by Pew, well-known the American organisation, Pew Research Organisation, and they are forecasting that by 2070, Muslims will become more a higher percentage of the global population than the Christians. The Christians are there in red, and the Muslims are there in green. That's their forecast.
Go on. A quick question. As a potential, let's just say, non-believer, it's like, that sounds really cool. I want to be on the winning team. I can see a chart like that.
Sure.
So How does that affect? Maybe we can chat about that.
We can chat about it. I'm talking to you as Christian. I'm just letting you know. And actually, facts are facts. If they are facts, I have to say, I have seen other statistics which say that actually Christianity is growing faster than Islam by conversion growth.
Yeah.
Significantly. There are many more people converting to Christianity than they are to Islam. And even on demographics, Christianity and Islam are growing at roughly the same level. So I've seen other projections. But no matter. I just want to whip through this to give you an idea that you cannot pretend that Islam is not a big issue. But globally, let alone in the United Kingdom. So here we have millions share of the world population. Here we have Muslims and non-Muslims. You can see the proportion is growing as time goes on. So by 2030, they're forecasting over a quarter, 26.4% of the world population will be Muslim. Again, you can debate these statistics till they come home, and I don't want to get into that debate now. The multiplying minarets, Muslim population in selected countries. France is going to go, 2010 is the light blue, and 2030 is the forecast of the dark blue. And you can see France is growing up to past 10%, right down to the United States here, quite a small percentage, but growing everywhere. The proportion of Muslims in population in all these countries, if you can see behind this light, I think nobody's going to argue that the Muslim population is going to decline in Europe. I think that's probably fair. So, excuse me, just another indicator. Muhammad is now the top name in Britain. Of course, it's by various spellings and so on, but it's the top name of boys' name in Britain. Over here, population in by towns in Europe. Oh, I can use this thing, can't I? Marseille, 30%, down to London, I see the figure is 12%. I've seen lower figures, we were debating this yesterday, but whatever the accurate figures, it is a significant portion, okay, there. And the UK proportion, in the UK proportion of Muslims, Bradford, 25%, down to London again, 12%. So, again, just rough figures. I'll skip that one. Spread of ISIS, this is, I'm going to skip through it, but this is... where ISIS is now already having an impact. Jay can talk more about this, but right the way across, ISIS is having its impact. Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Syria, all instances, right across Afghanistan and indeed in Pakistan. This, according to ISIS themselves, and it's been picked up by Twitter feeds and so on, this is their five-year plan. This is what they want to take over in the next 5 years. Whether they achieve that is another matter, but that is what they're aiming at. This has been picked up from all their Twitter feeds and their work on the social media and so on, those that research it. So their planned expansion is massive. We'll wait to see if they achieve it. Just another statement from the United States, quite well known. Islam isn't in America to be equal to any other faith, but to become dominant. The Quran should be the highest authority in America. Take out America, put in Belgium, put in Sweden, put in wherever you like. And Islam, the only accepted religion on earth. Okay, so that's by the chairman of the of CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. Sharia law, again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because it's not particularly what we're on about today, although I could talk at length about Sharia law, especially the gender discrimination, which I've done a lot of research into there and there. So I think we'll... is Sharia as a parallel legal system? Sharia finance, massively growing in the UK. I'm not going to again stop on that, but it's growing very fast. And here we have our dear Prime Minister stating at the Ninth World Islamic Forum in 2013, held in London. That's the first time ever outside the Islamic world. And our Prime Minister went there, and this was his statement. Already London is the biggest centre for Islamic finance outside the Islamic world. And today our ambition is to go further still. Because I don't just want London to be a great capital of Islamic finance, the Western world. I want London to be standalone Dubai as one of the great capitals. Not quite sure the difference. I think it means greatest capital of Islamic finance anywhere in the world. So that's that. Islamic banking. We've got Islamic banks, and they're buying up the Arab money is buying up large chunks of Britain at the moment.
Also Milan.
Sorry.
Also in Milan, they have built a lot of buildings.
Absolutely, it's happening. All they're investing. Here you go, the London project, 7%, in 2012, 7.5% was bought by Middle East investors. 2014, 20% of the purchases were by Middle East investors. Barclays Bank, well, they bailed out Barclays during one of our big banks. The Qatar Investment Authority bailed out Barclays during the 2008 crash. Canary Wharf, which is this huge building in London, Qatar has bought that for $4 billion. The American embassy, the Americans have moved out of their old embassy building, and Qatar bought that for $500 million. The Olympic Village, which is very close to where I live in East London, Qatar bought that to convert it into that. The most expensive block of flats in the world is One Hyde Park, and that is Qatari-owned. Harrods have bought $1.5 million. There we go. Sainsbury's, well, they own 5.99% of that. The Shard, one of our new buildings, will own 95% owned
tallest
by the Qataris. Sorry?
Tallest in Europe.
It's the tallest in Europe, yep. Just a very well-known building. Regent's Park. It looks like they're making another, the Qatari royal family are making another palace there, in fact. They bought this massive building. Regent's Park is prime space in London. And now, interestingly enough, the Qatari royals now own more property in the United Kingdom than the Crown Estate.
The Queen.
Wrap your mind around that. The Qataris now own more property in the United Kingdom than the Queen. And energy supply, well, the Britain's liquid natural gas, 25% of that now comes from the Qataris. So it's 95%, which is 25% of our total gas supply comes from the Qataris. So that's really where we are. So that's really what we're saying to people when we go around the church, and what we're saying to you is there is no doubt whatsoever the rising issue is Islam. Okay? Now, many people will say, well, what's wrong with Sharia finance? So I'm not going to get in that debate today, but imagine if you want to see what happens if the Chinese, what would the government say if the Chinese invested at that sort of level, or in Cold War days if the Russians invested at that sort of level in the United Kingdom? Everybody would be up in arms. But actually, when it comes to Islam, nobody's batting an eyelid. People are staying asleep. Not batting an eyelid. So our job is to engage and encourage people to get engaged with Islam. That is what we need to do. Now, the question is, how do we do that as Christians? And this is the question I want to put to you. How do we do that as Christians? So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show a video. The purpose of the video is we show this video on the roadshow, and the video is built around the campaign which I mentioned that I was led with others, but I led against the mega mosque. And when this happened, you'll see in the video, when I took up the campaign 8 years ago, I was absolutely certain that it had to be run Christianly. I had to run the campaign, as I've worked with other Christians as well, we had to do it Christianly. And I think that'll become clear. We're going to work right the way through the video, and then I'm going to get some discussion and debate around the issues that are raised in that, okay? Because I think, for me, it's quite clear, if Christians feel what they are doing can be smiled on by God, if God is in favour of what they're doing, if they're behaving the way God would want them to, then they can take on the world, okay? And they can certainly take on Islam. So we'll watch this video for a few minutes, and then we're going to discuss and debate the issues that it raises, and that's where we'll get into the full discussion. Is that okay?
How should a Christian confront and challenge the things that are around? What is the Christian response to the political and social issues around us? In other words, what is God's way? This is not the first time this question has been asked. You see, the great Christian campaigners down the ages had some important Christian principles which they held. They feared God more than man. They loved their neighbours. They spoke the truth. And they focused on their mission. Our own story starts back in 2005. The Sunday Times newspaper wrote an article about a radical Islamic sect who were planning to build a mosque in West Ham in London, making it their global HQ, with a capacity of 10 times that of St Paul's Cathedral. Tabliki Jamaat, the separatist group behind the mosque, are hostile to non-Muslims and see other Muslims as religiously inferior. They see women as possessions and use their mosques as platforms for promotion of their ideology. You're a Christian. You live near it. You're sure it's wrong, but do you ignore it? Isn't it only nasty, racist people that oppose mosques? How can you avoid fighting in the wrong way? The age-old Christian principles apply. They help us stand between two forces. It's not the do-nothingism, the politically correct, or the hatred and despair of the BNP. The Christian approach offers a more excellent way, and we will explore it together. Alan Craig, a Christian, did live near the proposed mosque, and he decided to set up the Mega Mosque No Thanks campaign. The campaign was not perfect, but it's a story about how to apply Christian ideals to the messy, fallen world we live in. Fear God, not man. Having decided to stand up and oppose the mosque, things got harder as expected. willing to despair or losing track of the plan? Can you be sure you're doing the right thing? How do you overcome fear of men? The way out is what people have always done. Go back to the core, the vision, the dream. What do you stand for? As a Christian, you'll need to be sure God will smile at your campaign. Wisdom always springs from the fear of God. Right back on a winter morning in 2005, Alan faced the choice to do nothing or to act. A simple phone call from a senior church minister was a defining moment for Alan. It set in motion the idea that he had a moral obligation to act. Alan knew that God wanted him to stand up, to oppose the mosque, not out of hatred of Muslims, but instead to oppose what Tabliki Jamaat espoused and promote. This was the Christian thing to do. It's this confidence that God would be pleased that sustained him, even when others wanted to take his vision somewhere else. Love your neighbour. In the heat of the campaign, personal attacks came from everywhere. On one occasion, a hostile young Muslim man set up a website making libelous claims, trying to link Alan to neo-fascist groups. This man lived in Alan's community. But Alan did the unusual thing. To the man's surprise, Alan arrived at his doorstep, unannounced, for a cup of tea and a chat. But this was just the start. Alan sent him a card when the man's child was born. In fact, the man responded, and the goodwill started to go both ways. Rather than demonizing your neighbours, the Christian way of love your neighbour was far more innocent. Of course, not everyone was willing to receive the right hand of friendship. The trustees of the mosque refused to meet. Respect for opponents and honouring their right to campaign was part of the DNA of Alan's campaign. After all, apart from God's grace, we too may be on the other side of the dividing line. This campaign was never meant to be a Christian crusade against Muslims. Instead, it was to be gracious and civil, separating people from their ideology. Speak the truth. When you oppose something, the pressure to oversimplify may be tempting. But unless what you say is 100% true and accurate, you can undermine your own point. Commentator Steve Emerson infamously claimed Birmingham was a no-go area for non-Muslims. His inaccuracy made him an international joke. This is an extreme example, but playing fast and loose with the facts in the rush to get the story out is dangerous. In contrast, the Christian campaigners researched their facts because Christians are people of the truth. Alan studied to the Jamaat for 6 months before going public. He went where the facts led. You see, both the FBI and French intelligence viewed Tabliki Jamaat as a terrorist recruiter, a claim that could be bolstered by their known links with the Pakistani Taliban and other militants. It would have been powerful headlines for Alan to call them a terrorist organisation. The problem is, the truth is much more complex. While such a claim would have furthered our campaign, it was not fully true. The end does not justify the means. We must be true at every step. Machiavelli may approve of cutting corners, but Christ would not. The facts Alan discovered led to something more subtle and harder to argue, but more true. Tabliki Jamaat were not a terrorist organisation, and they don't advocate terrorism, but they are Muslim separatists and isolationists, and terrorism has sometimes been a byproduct of such separatism. You see, in practice, what happened in Mindanao in the Philippines demonstrates dramatically the effect of Tabliki Jamaat's ideology. There used to be good local relations between Catholics and Muslims, but what changed? Tabliki Jamaat appeared on the scene and actively promoted their hostility to Catholics. Social and religious barriers grew up, despite calls against this from local Muslim businessmen who had lost business as a result. The same isolating effect happened in Dewsbury, in the UK. If Alan had picked the wrong one for the sake of a good headline, it would have undermined the Christian integrity of the campaign. If you can't back it up, don't say it. The greater and more controversial the claim, the greater the need for cast iron facts and killer evidence. The facts are checked, the message is clear, it needs to be communicated. When it comes to an approval, then Islam, most of your hearers feel like strangers struggling to navigate an ancient world, unable to separate myths and reality. They will certainly be sceptical of any political outsiders. When the campaign started, even questioning Islamic groups was unorthodox, and many Christians refused to engage in any debate about Islam. If we had any hope of bringing people on side, we had to be attractive and friendly. Words and tone had to be picked carefully. The name of the campaign itself was chosen carefully. The BNP might have chosen the brutal Stop the Running Mosque, but Alan and the team chose the more respectful Mega Mosque No Thanks. We had to persuade based upon values common to all. make sense to people of any faith and none. Christian jarring was to be avoided, as it made little sense to those people. The truth had to get out. Press releases were sent, and the local media was embraced, whatever they say about it. The local newspaper loved to mock Adam, and even laugh at him because his friends were upside down. They ran stories sympathetic to the mosque, without acknowledging the But Adam had to fight on, holding them accountable to their journalistic duty to report both sides. On one occasion, the mosque's architect bragged that it would be larger than Battersea Power Station. This claim was an open goal, so Alan prepared a full-sized advert to be placed in the local paper. The money was paid, it was all ready to go, but at the last minute, through fear, the paper refused to run it and refunded the money. Undeterred, the team pushed on and printed postcards for every house in the borough with a feedback form on the back. Knockbacks will come, but the story must get out. Leaflets, debates, and videos went out, all facts and no spin. Little by little, the people came on board. Not just Christians, but moderate Muslims, atheists, and others. The ice was thawing, and it was becoming freer to engage in civil debate. Stay focused. Building good alliances with others is essential, but we must be shrewd, focusing on what is right for the campaign. Many wanted to bribe for the campaign. Alan even got invited to speak at a large pan-European anti-mosque event. But he refused. Staying focused and saying no kept his campaign message clear. He was not anti-mosques in general. He was anti-this mosque. He was also a good tactic to keep the BNP away. Staying on revision and not getting distractions was the only way to get things done. Fear God more than man. Love your neighbour. Speak the truth. Stay focused.
Okay, so we've got a bit of time left. You can see there's four different points which my team and I worked out. We're all Christians. We worked that out. And I think what we have worked out for ourselves is that if Christians follow the Christian path with whatever they're doing, and it's not just applicable to Islam, but if they follow the Christian path and do it the Christian way and are aware that God will smile on what they do, then actually they can drive the campaign through. Otherwise, what do you get? What we showed on there, you get either the BNP and the hard right who are shouting hatred at the Muslims and creating friction, or you get, on the other hand, you get the liberal left, if I can put it like that, the politically correct left who won't do anything. And that is why I think it is the Christians who, empowered by and encouraged by their Christian beliefs, actually can tackle these issues. So what I wanted to do, whether you accept those ones or not, I think I want to discuss each one of those four. I think it would be quite useful if you can discuss each one of those four, partly so that you can wrap your own minds around it and see whether you agree with us on this particular one. Remember, the first one was fear God, not man. That, I have to say, for me, was absolutely critical. Once, for me, you saw the phone call I got from a senior minister who just asked me about it. He didn't tell me I've got to do this, but just as we were talking, it became absolutely clear to me that I had to get engaged in this particular campaign, that God was calling me. Then that was a huge motivator. I think the question, really, I'd like to put to you is that something you've experienced in your own life? Not necessarily to do with Islam, but actually when you've found that you had to follow God, fear God, love God, if you like, whatever you want to put it, however you want to put it, more than man, because the two are in conflict. You saw, and I'll leave it, but you saw the influence. I had quite a lot of criticism from Christians who tried to divert me off. And at the end of the day, I had to say, I'm doing this for God as I understand it, and therefore I'm not even listening to Christians who are criticising. But can I just throw that out as a starter? Well, yes, Yannis.
So I was going to ask you a question. How did Christians try to move you away from what you did before you accomplished it? What was the argument?
There were two arguments specifically from Christians. One was Christians should not be involved in any sort of criticism of Islam because all you're doing is being a crusader. Therefore, Christians, particularly Christians, should not get involved with engaging with them. And I got that from a senior black church leader. And he was really quite angry with my involvement about the whole thing. He said, I'm doing Christianity no good at all. And the other ones that were Christians that wanted me to get involved in a broader campaign against Islam, and that we come to later on talking about the focus. They put a huge amount of pressure, such that at one stage I had to withdraw from the campaign because they put pressure on for me to get more involved in a broader campaign against Islam. I thought that would not do this campaign any good whatsoever, to be seen as anti-Islam.
Yeah.
My calling for this one was this mosque. It's on my doorstep. That's what I got to stop. Okay, Gerald.
I have an ongoing issue with fearing God and not man. It's a constant battle for me. I do go out sometimes on the streets with Stratford, distribute literature, engage Muslims, and things like that. But I'm terribly uncomfortable. I it's really not in my personality, etc., etc. I have to, so to go out is a kind of a death to me, death for self, which is, hey, that's actually what I'm called to. But actually, it's 1,000 deaths in many ways. And it's, I haven't broken through yet. It sounds like you've broken through in certain regards in that, and that's wonderful. I have yet to break through. But definitely, we need to, that's my aspiration. I seek God's help, empowerment, to fear him and not man.
I can actually sympathise with you on that. It was just on this particular one. Everybody else, any examples from your own life when you found this sort of conflict, and you found it quite difficult, quite costly?
I know that when I first started out in missions, that the greatest temptation for me was just to run away from it all, because I did fear man more, and I was concerned with what their thoughts of me were more than what God was calling me to do. And I think it's sometimes how a lot of us Christians don't end up sometimes pursuing the very thing God wants us to pursue, because Christians do criticize us for what we're doing, or Muslims or atheists or whoever it may be can be quite cruel to our faith, not just to our faith, but actually to us as people. And so that's where the fear and love of God just has to reign supreme in our lives. I'm someone who's debilitated by fear quite often. I don't know if others are. And that's my thorn in my flesh, where fear is just a battleground. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of Christians in the world could resonate with that. And it's something we've just got to really think through, especially in regards to Islam. Mm-hmm. Because we could debilitate ourselves and not obey God to actually act, as you're saying, on a more strategic political level and act on just a purely evangelistic level. I think it's crucial we address it in our own hearts and in the church in general.
And if we fear God more than them, the fear of man, be they Muslims who are going to behead us or whatever, actually that's what will motivate us.
And to see it as a privilege to actually lose our head for God, if that's what it comes to.
The interesting thing, though, is I don't actually fear being hit or harmed or killed. That seems to me, I mean, I don't want to flip it, that almost seems easier. If that's the dilemma. But it's being
humiliated.
Somebody thinking you're an idiot or those losers. I mean, it's these simple things that are more precious than my neck. Because I actually believe I'm probably more willing to die for God than be humiliated
or
thought
badly
of.
Powerful.
Sort of my experiences, obviously a lot of people here have been through way more, aggressiveness than I've ever been faced with. But just sort of that, when you can tell God's, wanting you to jump in or, to be that one person that calls someone else out in the room, those types of situations. But so often they turn out perfectly fine. And, the conversation totally becomes more, I thought they were going to, insult me or say, humiliate me. And it actually just turns into a fruitful discussion or... someone actually agrees with my point and realizes that they're wrong in their argument. And that, step by step has really, encouraged my faith, and I still have, so much more to go, but it's encouraged, how God just sets up his situations and he is faithful to us, or if we lose our heads, but God is still faithful. So it's going to make heaven.
Here's something that we try not to live out of fear, because we very definitely are called to fear God and not man, and not to live out of fear. But it creeps back in again. Yeah. And so it's, for a Christian, my personal experience is it's a constant battle. And it is one of the battles that we should be fighting.
I'm married to a wonderful wife, and she was marvellous at one stage when it came to this fear thing. I went to church one day, and somebody, a great friend of mine, church, had said, "Are you aware that there's a death threat for you up on YouTube? The people associated with this mosque have put it up on YouTube." I said, no idea at all. They said, well, you need to watch it. It went up last night. And it's basically in memory of Alan Craig is what it's all about. And we hadn't seen it. We heard it in church that Sunday morning. And I remember driving home. We stopped the car. We had the girl, two young daughters. They were then aged 5 or 7, so they were just playing in the back there. And we stopped the car on the way back. And we hadn't seen the video. We were aware of it. And my wife said, Alan, this may be huge. We are going to follow God, not man. Mm. That's what she said. That's absolutely huge. So she said, this is not going to have any impact on us whatsoever. God has got us to do this. We're going to, therefore going to do it. Our lives are going to continue. And so we drove home and we watched the video. And it was a pretty horrific video. Even more horrific was she and my two daughters featured in the video, which, as it happened, God works all these things. I went to the police and they arrested the guy, but we also told the press, and the press went to town on the Muslims. They wouldn't have done, I think, if it was just me, but because they had my daughters aged 5 and 7 featuring in the video, and Sally, indeed, they had her featuring it as well, the media went to town on it. But it was her response straight away that was such an encouragement to me, because I thought, I've got family and all the rest of it. She said, no, God has put us here. We're not going to fear anything. We're going to carry on with our lives. Another interesting story, if I can just tell you this. Well, the police arrested the guy, and they then came to me. They take victim statements, okay? Thank you. They take victim statements from the victims when there's been a crime like this. And the police came and said, well, we're considering whether to prosecute. We've arrested the man. We're considering whether to prosecute or not him. But we need to know, how has this impacted your family? How has this impacted you? And I said, well, it hasn't impacted us at all. As a matter of faith, we're just getting on with our lives. So are you not losing any sleep at night? No, we're not losing any sleep at night. Has your life been curtailed? No, our life hasn't been curtailed. So he said, well, actually, we may therefore not prosecute. And I was aghast and actually quite angry. I said, look, I'm happy to support you, whatever, on this. If there's a crime that's been committed, prosecute the guy. It's not a question of how we feel as a family. If we hadn't been a Christian family, if my wife hadn't been so courageous, we could well not be sleeping at night. We might have moved home or something. I don't know. But just as an interesting story, the British legal system now cannot allow for that. They have to be subjective. Any other comments about this fearing God? Yes,
Francesco. I really like this project. It has a biblical foundation, because Jesus says we are the salt of the world, and we need to do something like this. Did you? And so it has a Christian attitude. We really like it. We like this. Sometimes there are people maybe who want to join you without having Christian attitudes, try to maybe instrumentalize your good job, which we approve, but then they might jump into this project without Christian attitude. Did you come across with these people? How do you tell them, please do not confuse, I'm not doing a war, etc., etc.? Because they might be rude,
Absolutely. One of my real problems all the way through, and this campaign has run on for 8 years now, my problem all the way through was the BNP, the British National Party, the far right party, might decide to come and crawl over this project. And clearly they couldn't make up their mind what to do it. Up on their website, they put stuff up praising me at one stage and saying, this guy, Alan Craig, is stopping this mosque, well done. They put this stuff up there, which wasn't very helpful to me. But on the other hand, later on, they criticised because I wasn't taking a hard enough line against Muslims. Okay. But my fear was they'd come over the horizon. They'd go and throw pig's trotters on the mosque site or whatever they want to do and completely foul the whole thing up. And I was really delighted. To us, it was an answer to prayer that the BNP at no stage have come over the horizon. They've got involved with all sorts of mosques being built all up and down the United Kingdom. They never came near our project. I didn't want secular people involved, because if they come, hatred will be involved, and we didn't want any of that. So, yeah. Shall I move us on? Any other comments on this one? There's a sort of discussion we want to have with Christians in the churches when we go around, so begin to wrap their minds around it.
I like your point at the very end there, Anna, and you said you didn't want necessarily those who would be without belief and antagonistic to join, because there would be no love in what they're saying. And actually, people, what you've done is actually an act of love. In the sense, people think, well, why is he criticising this mosque, etc.? but actually you are actually acting out of love, out of Christian love.
Yes.
And I think it's very important to push that message.
Yeah. Great evangelistic method.
Sorry?
Great evangelistic method. I mean, there are many aspects to the whole gospel, but one of them is surely showing how we should be dealing with each other if we've got a problem.
I mentioned this Nigerian church leader in London who said very critically, he said, "You're going to foul up the gospel." He said, "Actually, it's interpreted as a Christian crusade against Muslims, and therefore it will not promote the gospel." So I just had to disagree. I couldn't persuade him. So so there. Let's move on. Did you want to say?
I can get back to him on another point.
Okay, let's go on to the second point. The second point was love your neighbour. And this was absolutely critical for our campaign. Now, we've discussed this quite a lot, separating the ideology, or in this case, separating the project from the people. Now, I have to say, I don't think they saw the difference. Certainly when the campaign started, the insults I got from white secular people and from Muslims were quite horrendous. Well, they would have been horrendous, except I didn't mind anymore, because it's a question of fearing God, not man. I was quite convinced. But the names I got called on this were being Islamophobic and racist and far-right and fascist and a whole gamut of stuff that you get called for it. Because they, especially the Muslims, cannot separate. They just saw the whole thing as attack on Islam and therefore on themselves. It's highly personal to them. But actually, in our minds, we are able to separate, and that's how we do things. Yeah. In our society, we separate state from religion, and we can separate the ideology or the project from the people. And it was really important for me to do that. But I am concerned, and I just want to throw this out, I am concerned. We had a little bit of a debate on the first day about the concept of love and how it becomes an operational word, because in many ways it can be just a cop-out. You know, all you've got to do, you've heard, haven't we discussed it, the best thing to do with Muslims, just love them. We'll love them into the kingdom. How often have you heard that one?
Here at the conference,
we've heard it at the debate and so on. So how do we get inside this? How do we make it an operational concept that actually we can operate in love and yet still get on and do things? Or out of that love, get on and do things and confront things and challenge things and oppose things and propose things too. How do we get inside that? It's really quite important.
One of the women in our Bible study circle runs a bed and breakfast, and a Muslim family came to study in Barkening and needed a place to stay. She would not normally have taken a family in, but they couldn't find something, and she thought, well, maybe a good opportunity. And I don't know that she has had so much contact with him, but with her of this two-studying group, she's given love. She's helped watch the child. She's given Dutch lessons where they were really necessary, English lessons where they were necessary to try to, so that the woman would meet the requirements to continue her studies. But what's happening, and finally, she was not getting some official papers through that were absolutely necessary. Her child couldn't get out of school so she could go to a necessary conference in another country to finish her studies. The child was 5 and couldn't get out of school. Well, we're going to pray. We'll pray and we'll ask Jesus, said Korka. And they prayed. But this was the end of a trajectory. This wasn't the start. This was the end of months of walking beside each other and showing love. What's come out of it is amazing.
Okay, yeah.
Because Jesus answered. The principal called and said, an exception has been made. This is absurd not to let this child out because you have to do it for your studies, and off you go. And she came running. Jesus answered.
Okay, yeah, okay. Anybody else? Any other comments on this? Yeah.
Yeah, this is also something that's, you know, not, I guess, the fussy, but really practical thing that I do, which I come from, obviously, a really different situation, where in Texas, like Bush is from Texas, so there's like a huge Islamophobia, all Muslims are terrorists sort of idea. And so taking like my Christian friends who are, you know, think I'm insane that I go inside a Muslim's house and like, you know, they're gonna kill you someday or whatever, but taking them inside with me and kind of telling them like, you don't have to talk and they don't want to talk anyways, but modeling out like a loving and friendly conversation, having a meal with them, but still being pointed and not just ignoring, you know, their issues, but, you know, talking about religion. And then they always leave and they're like, oh, I didn't know it was going to be like that. Or, you know, you know, it's just interesting that everyone I've ever done that with, they change their view. They change their view on Islam if they were more passive about it, and they also change their view of the Muslim people as, you know, they're not out to get you. And some of them obviously are, but yeah, it's just like a really good technique that I've been using.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I think you hit on it, Alan. I think there's something about desiring good for the other and seeking to facilitate good for the other. And in different contexts, I mean, obviously anybody who is not safe in Christ needs something called the gospel, which tells us a story about how they become safe in Christ. This wasn't a gospel project. This was a loving your neighbor project. So this was seeking the good of others and seeking to facilitate it. So you were seeking the good of other Muslims and other mosques in the neighborhood, because there was a particular type of Islam and a particular type of particular size of a mosque that was coming in to unbalance what currently exists, which is not perfect, but it currently exists and probably proves along with difficulties, I'm sure. But making the situation worse is something to say no thanks to. So I think there's something, the love has to have this practical dimension to it.
For myself in this one, I retranslated the word love into respect. Okay, to make it operational, I thought, what I was saying the other day, I couldn't love everyone, I didn't know them all. But the basis of the whole campaign was respect for the Muslims. They are British citizens, they are allowed to propose their mosque.
Yes.
So, not again, they're allowed to. I'm allowed to propose a mosque if I want to, they're allowed to propose it. But actually, so am I as a British citizen, I'm allowed to oppose it as well. But respecting their rights, respecting them as people, and it was mentioned in that, the very first thing I did before I actually started the campaign at all, went public on the whole thing, I know the guy who was then the project manager for the mosque, and I phoned him up and I said, Abdul, I said, I want to come and talk to you about your mosque project. I've met him at social accounts and civic occasions and things like that, so I knew him quite well. I want to come and talk to you about their project. I want to give them respect. I want to go and talk to them about the issues. He actually refused to meet on, which surprised me quite a lot. He actually refused to meet. So I said, well, I want to meet the trustees. I want to put out the right hand of friendship to the trustees. I want to go and talk to them about their mosque. I want to tell them why I think it's wrong and so on. But they refused. But I thought, well, I can do no more. I want to give, at all stages, I want to give them personally respect. No matter what their project, no matter what they're doing, I want to give them respect. And that was how I made the whole thing operational in this sort of context. Respect for them as people. Oh, thank you very much. Respect for them as people. And provided I'm respecting them, I can disagree with their project as much as I like. I respect them. In council speak, I'm told, there is the secular council speak. It's a very similar wording, which I quite like, sort of express it. Love is, in secular terms, is unconditional positive regard. Unconditional positive regard. And I think that actually sums up how I felt about the trustees and the Muslims. When I met them, any of the individuals, I got on well with them. Absolutely no problem at all. If you give them unconditional positive regard, that is Christian love as people. And I found that hugely liberating. I mean, I found it empowering to know, actually, I have no problem with them as people. I have no problem. Therefore, I can do what I want. I can be as rude as I like about their mosque because I have no problem with them as people. I like them as people. Sorry, Peter.
In discussion with them, did you... I guess you had to give like a rational argumentation for why we're opposed to the mosque. But did you ever get into the discussion about Islam? And were you frank that you believe that Islam is a false religion and so on?
No, I got into... I didn't have a lot of discussions with them. I did have discussions... No, still to this day, I have never had a discussion with the elders.
But you said you got...
Okay.
Individuals,
I'd bump into them in the street and they'd go to the mosque and they'd realise who I was and they'd have a discussion in the street because I lived just a mile from the mosque, so I'd have a discussion.
What would be the content of that discussion?
Sorry?
The content was
not about Islam in general, but it was about the ideology of Tablighi Jamaat, the group behind the mosque. I knew that ideology better than they did. I had studied and studied it. I knew it. I'd researched it. I'd followed it right the way around the world. And I loved to discuss it.
Yeah,
so they'd
try
and say, well, this is what it's about. I said, not about that at all. You've got 6 points of Tablighi. Let's go through your 6 points of Tablighi, and so on. So I'd had that discussion with them because I knew my stuff.
Imagine it had been a mega church of that size that they were trying to put up down the street. I might have joined you in complaining too.
Well, I made that point to them. I said, look, this is not about the... I don't like your ideology. What happens if the Ku Klux Klan claim to be Christians? What happens if they want to come, highly divisive Christians, okay, just as separatists in a different way, and racial terms rather than religious terms, if they decided, I'd often use this, if they wanted to come and put a church up here, I'd be out here objecting to them just as much. Yeah. That is the problem. They would be just as divisive as you are. And I'd say that to their faces. Sorry, yeah. Any other points on this one? But I really believe that this thing about loving your neighbour, whatever you're doing, is a liberating thing. Absolutely, for Christians, absolutely liberating. If you know you love the people, you can be as honest and as blunt as you want to be to them about their project or about their ideology and so on. Liberation is what we need. We need to liberate Christians from being constrained and hiding away in the corner and say, let's get out there, let's love them, and let's argue and discuss with them.
This is something that I think we need to really encourage Christians to talk about with secular people, because I was reading a journalist comment in one of the newspapers in England very recently, and he said, I don't believe people who say, and he was basically referring to Christians, but people who say they can love the person but hate the ideology. And I've heard a lot of atheists and secular people say that because they have no concept of being able to actually love a person and hate their ideology. But those of us who love Muslims and Christians who love atheists and Muslims or Hindus or whatever religion it is, we absolutely have to love and can love the person, but we can absolutely hate their ideologies. And I think this is something that, you know, you have
I found the more powerful word when talking to secular people is I don't hate that. I really respect these people. They have absolute rights to propose the mosque, but I have an absolute right to oppose it, and I give them full respect. And that seemed to speak more to secular people than to say, well, actually, I love them, but I don't like their mosque. I think it's such a devalued and expansive word. It can mean anything to anybody now that I think we need to find other words when speaking and communicating it. I'm going to move on because I think we've only got about 7 minutes. I would like to just see if we can finish the different points and then one other quick point at the end. The one about telling the truth, it's an obvious one, really, isn't it? Christians, we should tell the truth. We should always tell the truth. But actually, in this sort of campaign, and in many times, if you look at yourself, it's very difficult not to bend the thing to try and make your case persuasive. And we found it. We really had to discipline ourselves. And we gave the example of we could have used, because this fundamentalist sect is so closely associated with terrorist groups back in Pakistan, we could have made that link. And indeed, we were urged by some people to tell them they're a terrorist. Of course they're terrorists. You know. But we didn't. We chose a different way, and actually, in the long run, a more powerful way of describing them. But the question is, how can you promote the truth, as you see it, the truth of whatever you are, without spinning? You know, the concept of spinning, you know, public relations people spin it. It's a very fine... Anybody any ideas about that one? How do we draw the distinction between the two? Promote the truth, that's what your job is to do, to tell the truth about your project or about what you're doing, but not to spin it and make it manipulative.
Well, yeah, that way I think the description in the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments... in Norway, we often think of it as they say, you shall not lie. But actually what it says, if I'm correct, is do not bear false witness, which means more like a broader that you shouldn't represent things in a way which is... So I think that's a good way to keep in mind that even like representing just slightly in a skewed light is not to do what we should do as Christians. But I have a question on that. I don't know if you have the time. We could talk about it later if you want. But when distancing yourself from the BNP and that kind of people, aren't you in danger of doing the same to them that a lot of Christians do to you? Because you're talking about if you dare get them involved, there's a lot of hatred. And the way they are displayed in this video and such, just like, I mean, this is nitpicking, but aren't you kind of heaping some generalizations of some... on them that maybe some of them would be uncomfortable with, and maybe not all of them are, maybe they have some genuine concerns and are not motivated by hate, all of them, maybe.
There is a difference between what I don't think the words BNP came out of my mouth during the whole campaign. I never mentioned the BNP. I was privately praying, 5 minutes, privately praying and urging my colleagues, we have nothing to do with them whatsoever. I wasn't criticising the BNP, I didn't do that as such. They made a lot of comments about me.
This video was not part, this was made after the campaign?
Yeah, we just made it, this is the first proper showing of the final edition. We haven't had previous editions, so yeah.
Right, okay. So,
yeah, it's part of the roadshow, yeah. I think I want to move on. We've only got 5 minutes left. To me, truth is about intentionality. What do you intend with what you're putting out there? If you know that actually you're just bending it slightly to make it more acceptable, and your purpose is not pure and good in doing that, then to me that becomes spinning. Whereas actually, you can put a piece of fact out there and know it's going to have a bombshell. It's true, fully true. And it always helps me quite a lot. In British courts, you go to you affirm or you swear on the Bible in a British court of law that you'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So truth actually is very difficult. You've got to tell the whole truth. So therefore, your intentionality of telling the whole truth accurately, it may be a huge bombshell, and quite often we would throw these bombshells out like that, but they were fully true. What we were saying was fully true. But sometimes a temptation actually, this isn't the full story, but if I just bend and put a few more words, a little bit more of a description, put that out, it'll have a devastating effect on them. Does it? So the intentionality, you have to look at your own motives. That is, again, the liberating thing. What is going on in my own heart? Am I loving my neighbour? Am I telling the truth? If I know I'm telling the truth, it actually doesn't matter what other people, because God is watching.
Especially if you make somebody blacker than he actually is.
Some person, yes.
More negative when you use the word black. More negative than he actually is, then you're in dangerous territory.
Yeah. We would never, ever get personal refer to people, although we did refer to the group. The group, we saw that as different from individuals, but we never attacked individuals.
As a Christian, I don't want to overstate this, but actually Christians can tend to overstate things to get the good outcome, the desirable outcome, the glorification of God outcome.
Yeah.
It's not a good move. It's not a good role.
We must be terriers for truth, for the full truth.
The 10% that you've added, once that's exposed, the 100% that you, or the 90% that you did present, which was true, the whole thing is contaminated. The whole thing falls.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And if, at the long run, people will sense the integrity of your campaign. Well, I felt that of our campaign. People criticise, they still criticise it and the rest of it. But you feel that some of that sting has gone out of it because they're sensing you don't hate people, there is an integrity to your campaign, and slowly, bit by bit, you get people in the middle ground who aren't quite sure sort of come towards you and say, that's okay, that's all right, you get that. Last one, because I think we've probably got about a minute and a half left. Focus. There really isn't time to discuss it, but I think it's absolutely critical for a campaign like this. Focus. Single-mindedness. I love that bit in Hebrews 12, isn't it? You know, set your mind... we're surrounded by a great band of witnesses, but set your mind on Jesus. And that single-minded focus about the whole thing seemed to me we weren't going to get diverted, we weren't going to become part of a wider campaign, a pan-European campaign against mosques or whatever. Our job, our calling from God... was this particular mosque by this particular fundamentalist group, and to stay focused on it. I think I'm probably not going to have time to discuss before you. What I would like to just throw out for you, just actually for your comments on it, what is missing from that list as Christians? What is missing from that list? I'm thinking of doing an addendum to it, because I didn't put it on. There's one thing that's missing, prayer. Absolute prayer. We haven't put it on so far because the whole thing was soaked in prayer. We had people praying for us up and down the country, praying for the campaign, praying for our safety, praying for our security. And we deliberately asked people to. We had somebody on our team who was purely responsible for getting often confidential information out to people we could trust to get them to pray about it. Prayer and fasting, actually, and fasting too, prayer and fasting. We haven't put it on the video, partly because it's get longer and longer and we put that, but also partly because we feel prayer is so much, ought to be so much part of everyday Christian life. So if you're making the tea after church, it's encompassed in the prayer life of the church. But I'd be interested to think if you think we ought to include it, perhaps put an addendum on the end or put it up the front or something. This is the first full showing of the final video. This is the one we're now going to be using. We've showed a previous church. We've showed this is the final version, but we're thinking of doing version 2. Thank you, time's up. Version 2, we're having a whole section on prayer and our prayer strategy and our fasting strategy during the campaign. Yeah, we've got to finish in a moment. Yeah, Francesco.
Do you have Do you explore also how to expand this ministry in other countries in Europe, or like in Italy and like in other countries, to expand it? Because I see in your website now, please contact us, speak at your church, I can talk with the Evangelical Alliance. By the way, do you think that you can expand this, or is it only for Britain?
I guess it's expandable. It's so new, it's sort of, we're sort of getting off the ground at the moment.
Most statistics are great.
Sorry?
Most all statistics.
Yeah, but I mean the concept, as a concept. Can we talk about Islam as a concept?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
We'd
love to.
Country had different, like you had the mega mosque that was going to be built in Italy, the biggest mosque in Europe. You had that issue.
We can adapt it, of course.
Absolutely, yeah. But very happy to help in any way.
It's not even really about the mega. You know, it's not really about that story. It's about the bigger story. And an ability to talk about it.
The measure of our success or otherwise will be whether, at the end of the day, when our roadshow moves on to another church or whatever you want to express it, whether the Christians, the ordinary Christian in the pew, feels more encouraged and empowered to tackle the issue of Islam and to engage with a Muslim next door neighbour and people around them. And if they want. A three-hour session with us going through this, and there's a lot more to the whole roadshow, won't necessarily of itself do it. But if it gets them interested and they want to do it, we will give them the information, give them the links on the website, introduce them to Fanda, and so on and so forth. So we want to get Christians on the move, so not hiding away in the corner and unwilling to discuss Islam and not willing to engage.
Yeah, let's just say, I mean, I've seen this campaign from the outside, that you know, you're on the news and everything, and it's an amazing thing you've done. And I would say, it's such an amazing testimony for Muslims, for atheists, because very unhuman to react like this. Yeah, you know, just people, you see them trying to blow up this, trying to blow up that. Mm. It's such an amazing testimony. Even it's a tool of evangelism.
Yeah.
Okay. It's also a way to help Christians understand and have courage to speak up against injustice in the society.
Yes,
at any level. It's a pilot project showing. Oh. And in that respect, very valuable.
Bless you. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, lovely. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.